I'm Bülent Alevizade, the director of the CSIS Turkey project. I'd like to welcome you all to today's meeting on Turkey's politics and economy after the recent elections. We're delighted to have with us the delegation from the Turkish Chambers of Commodity Exchanges, TOB, to use the very popular Turkish acronym, headed by President Rıfat Sercikdoğlu. The delegation also includes Tamer Taşkın, a member of the TOB board. TOB and CSIS are now in the third year of a cooperative effort to contribute to the development of U.S.-Turkish relations, particularly in the economic sphere, and today's meeting is very much part of that effort. As you can see from the invitations, this is a joint CSIS-NDI exercise. We're delighted to have NDI work with us on today's meeting. We had a pre-election meeting in June at the NDI offices, which Ambassador Nelson Litsky will remember, and this is a follow-up to that here at CSIS. Without further ado, I'd like to invite Dr. John Hamry, the president of CSIS, to open the proceedings and invite President Sercikdoğlu.
Thank you all. I'm delighted you're here, and thank you for coming. My role here is entirely ornamental. I mean, I have no substance to I know my wife laughs, too, when I say things like that. The last thing I would ever be is ornamental anything, but my role here really is to add just simply words of welcome to all of you, and thanks for coming. I would like to say thanks to TOB for being our partners with this. I think it demonstrates their strategic vision to keep alive a relationship that I believe is central for both of our countries. These last years have been disappointing. We've had an alienation that's grown between America and Turkey that I don't think is helpful for either country. And I can only say I'm disappointed that we're not appreciating more richly how much we need a constructive relationship with Turkey. When I think of all of the significant challenges that we face as a nation, we America face as a nation, Turkey is part of the answer. It's not part of the problem. It's part of the answer. It's part of the solution. And we need to start embracing this strategic relationship again with Turkey. We once had that. During the Cold War, we had a framework that governed us, and we knew why we needed to work through the good times and the bad times. And that's past, but it is no less vital and vibrant that we have this relationship now. Our friends in Europe have decided that they're not ready to have a closer relationship with Turkey. I think that's sad and unfortunate. But I do think it heightens ever more why the United States needs to strengthen its strategic relationship with Turkey. And I think that's part of the reason I wanted to come down here, was to say how crucial this is. And I want to thank you, President, for taking the lead to keep this bridge between us as we work this out. I'm convinced these years ahead are going to be years of rediscovery of a strategic relationship with Turkey and America that will be profoundly important for both of us going forward. And so I thank you for taking the time to join us today. I thank you for having this conference and your partnership with us here in Washington, trying to keep this point of view alive at a time when both of our countries are a little ambivalent about it. I'm not ambivalent about our relationship with Turkey. I feel very strongly about this, and I'm very proud that you've given us a chance to partner with you, President. I invite you to come up and share your thoughts, and we're going to have a very rich afternoon. President, please join me. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hamry. Ladies and gentlemen, it's a pleasure to be here and address such a distinguished group in Washington, D.C. Let me start by thanking CSIS and NDI for hosting this meeting. It's rather timely as so many things happened at a short span of time. We had two elections and a constitutional crisis in a short period of time. Hopefully, we have finally completed the political discussion process. It was a real distraction. Now is the time to turn back to the economy, to the economic transformation of the country. That is the task that we have got to complete. And we have to do it quickly, because the time is right. When I look back to 2001, I see a completely different Turkey. Back then, we were in the middle of an economic crisis. In the economic measures of 2001 paved the way for drastic economic and social change. As a result, Turkey has become more integrated in the global economy. Thanks to this macroeconomic stability, our customs union agreement with the EU became effective. If you need proof, take a look at our trade figures. Our exports have increased more than 100% in a few years. What is more impressive is that this happened while the Turkish lira appreciated even the nominal terms. Macroeconomic stability was also good for growth. While inflation was down to single-digit level, average growth has increased to 7.5% annually in the last 5 years. This is higher than our long-term growth average of 4.5%. Growth was not only high but also continuous throughout the last 20 quarters. Both are good, but we should be aware of the realities. And the business community of Turkey is aware of the realities. We know that Turkey was not the only country with this high growth performance recently. The whole world is changing very rapidly. Global competition is harsh. Turkey is now the 17th largest economy in the world. But we know that without a series of microeconomic reforms, Turkey won't even be able to secure her current position. And we do not only want to secure our position. We have got to improve it. And we know that we can improve it. That is the reason why in Turkey we should be back to business as soon as possible. I see an opportunity at the moment, especially after the election results. There might be more than one way of reading the election results in Turkey. But let me tell you how I see the results as a businessman. I see an opportunity. The election results have shown that there is a clear majority for economic transformation in Turkey. There lies the opportunity. Time is ripe to move forward in the economic reform process. There is a time of confidence in the markets and among businessmen. Now that the elections are over, I am expecting 5 more years of strong economic performance. This is true despite the growing problems regarding global liquidity. One has to look at the map to see the reason why. Within 3 hours of flight time from Turkey, you can reach 51 countries, a population of around 1 billion. And the total GDP of around 12 trillion US dollars. That's equal to 1/3 of the world's GDP. There is an area of major natural gas and oil routes. We have the potential to be in the center of land transport routes from Europe all the way to China. Turkey has a role to play in the global integration of regional economies. We could realize this objective if we could complete our EU transformation. Only a transformed Turkey would be able to play that role. I would like to conclude my remarks with the following. With its fast-growing economy effective institutional infrastructure, together with its strong secular and democratic traditions, Turkey is clearly a land of opportunities. Ladies and gentlemen, it was a pleasure addressing you here today. Thank you for your kind attention.
Thank you, President Sergic Doğulu. We will now proceed to the first of our panels, and I'd like to invite Ambassador Letsky and the three journalists who were part of the delegation that Tob came to the U.S. with, Murat Yetkin, Fehmi Koro, and Yalçın Doğan, please. Nelson, I suggest you grab this one. Go ahead. Please, Nelson, grab your chair. Kimin tercümanı? Her şeyin yanına. Davet et gelsin yanına her şey. Okay, just a couple of words before we proceed. I'm not going to have any role in this. It's going to be Ambassador Letsky. I'm an avid reader of all three of the newspapers that the gentlemen who are with us, like many people in this room, are, and as well as their columns, of course. And none of them need any introduction to the Turks. But as Nelson might touch on, if he wants, he's got the background on them. This ought to be a fascinating review of where we are. And without further ado, I invite my good friend Ambassador Letsky to take over.
Thank you, Bulent. My function here is merely to introduce the three journalists who have come from Turkey to tell us what's going on in their own country. I think all of us in the United States are used to the idea now that if one wants to get the news, the only way to get it is to have one journalist talk to another journalist. Officials don't no longer give speeches. The news comes from talking heads on television programs. And we've got three such talking heads here, all of them good heads, all of them very smart heads. I know two of the three of them from my past activities, my past crimes in Cyprus and other places in the Mediterranean. On my right is Fehad Korlu, who actually I don't know, but he's he writes a daily column. He co-hosts a political analysis program, and he's previously worked for two or three newspapers, and maybe he'll get a real job soon. Murat Yetkin is at the end of the table, and he's an old friend of mine from his days of the Turkish Daily News in Ankara. He, too, has got a political talk show on CNN Turk. And in the middle is Yaksin Dogan, who's a columnist for Hurriyet. But I've seen him both on television and read his stuff over the years. And we've met each other maybe 20 years ago. So I don't know who's going to begin, but we're going to have a lively discussion about what's going on in Turkey. You want to start?
Yeah. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Some of you may recall I was here in Washington together with Murat Yetkin about 6 months ago at Brookings to discuss the presidential potential political developments in Turkey. We tried to answer some questions, of course. Who would be the candidate for presidency? Whether early elections were in the offing? What would be the outcome of the upcoming elections? Who would benefit from the elections? How likely we would have a coalition government? Now we have answers to all these questions. The president was elected, and the general elections were held. AKP won a landslide victory in the elections and will rule the country single-handedly for another 5 years. The center-right parties of ANAP, Motherland, and DYP are no longer relevant. MHP was successful to a limited extent. It is represented in the parliament now, but its vote is behind its 1999 success. CHP received less than 20% of the votes. These election results, are they surprising? Many close observers of the Turkish political scene would feel that it was really surprising, but to me, at least, it wasn't really. The result was expected, and many of us who closely follow the Turkish, the last general election, felt that the imminent landsliding victory of the AK party was imminent. I myself joined the Prime Minister Erdogan when he was campaigning in several cities of Turkey, visiting, for example, Trabzon and Rize and some other Turkish cities. When I found out that the reaction of the public was so sincere and so hot, I felt that this election results will be even better than the previous one. But, you know, during those times of campaigning, some of the papers predicted, of course, the victory for AK party, but with some limited success, saying that it couldn't get more than 40% of the votes for a very basic reason of mathematics. Any party which got about 35% previously cannot really get more than 40%. This is against the mathematical tools. Well, this wasn't the case. Of course, it is pertinent to ask the question, how this did happen? I summarize some of my findings of this question. The other parties lost their traditional followers, and AKP convinced them to vote for it. When you look at the tables of the last three elections, you will see the erosion of DYP and Motherland, partial erosion of CHP and MHP. AKP was on the rise. But this can, of course, be easy to can make us easy to understand how this happened. But we have to ask another question: why did this happen? We in Turkey live under constant fear of three subjects. One was a little bit passé right now, was communism, and the second one, separatism or disunity. And the third threat was a fundamentalist threat. Whenever the system parties bombard the political atmosphere with these fears, people tend to stay away from voting fringe parties, regardless of their own ideological sympathies. Even most people who have some religious inclinations didn't vote for religiously inclined parties for the reason that they themselves can be considered as radicals or fundamentalists. Parties which position themselves in the center always have the upper hand in general elections. AKP, on its part, has positioned itself in the center, making itself a centrist party with some clever maneuvering and pushing some others to the fringe. Previously, parties which occupied the center came to be regarded as a fringe parties in the latest election. In July 22nd elections, AKP was not evaluated as a fringe party by the electorate, but a centrist party. AKP's position on European Union has helped boost its image as a centrist party, as well as never indulging in issues which are controversial. Local AKP organizations have worked very hard. Municipalities have always been on the lookout to help the poor ease up the problems of the needy. With the ascendancy of Abdullah Gül as a president, the AK party will be much freer to apply his own policies right now. When people will see that the threat assessment of the traditional ruling elites is no longer relevant, they will vote AKP in abundance in the coming elections. We will have local elections in maybe a year. AK party has a potential of attracting, it may come as a surprise to many, but it is my, at least, my assessment of it, as many as 70% of the votes. Those who feel that conservative politicians are a threat to their own being, and those leftists who traditionally never vote rightist or center-right parties will never side with AKP, but their number will not reach more than 30%. So this is the reality of the latest election in Turkey. And with this numbers and realities in mind, I believe there will be some more surprises in the years to come and the elections to come. I'll rest my case here.
Elections in 2002 is the failure of the coalition parties. Justice and Development Party came on power in 2002. Elections 2 months ago is the failure of the opposition. Erdogan won a victory within 47% majority, to which has not been reached for the last 45 years, I think. Although I'm not so optimistic as Fehmi Koru. Although Turkey feels herself not well because of the great question, are we undergoing through an Islamic regime, so-called moderate Islam? Do we lose our goal for 80 years, which has been essential subject for the Turkish Republic, the secularity? According to the constitution or to the laws, there is no danger in that sense. But the danger is on the daily life. A certain majority fears from the intervention to their private lives. It is, in practice, so-called local business, a change to a moderate Islamic way of life. There is no compulsory power, but, for example, in some places, if you go to a supermarket to buy and you want to buy an alcohol drink, the man says, "We do not sell alcohol anymore." That repeats in many places throughout the country. According to the Islamic rule, alcohol is forbidden. A change from the secular state to a moderate Islamic way of life, no compulsory, but step by step. Why do a certain majority feel himself so quarreled? Because the lack of compromising. Getting to yes in my country is very difficult. I am always right from here to eternity. If I am right, then I am right. And also the understanding of democracy. I am satisfied with the democracy as long as it fits with my values, with my way of life. If it disturbs my way of life, I don't like the democracy. That concept is very widespread through the country, from the housekeeper even till to the governing figures. So, the threat for the secular state and the fear of that is one of the major problems. The other main problem is terrorism, so-called PKK terrorism, the ethnic terrorism with which we have been living for 23 years. More than 30,000 people have been killed, have died, and more than $120 billion have been spent by fighting against terrorism. It is very ridiculous and remarkable that the Kurdish terrorism is being supported by 28 countries, according to the official sources. 28 countries, some of them are even our best friends from the EU countries. On that point, I would like to underline a very important point to your audience, to the American audience. The Turkish people are watching to the American support by fighting together against terrorism. But until now, we are only waiting that support which hasn't reached yet. As a last word, I have to confess that there is a great lack of opposition which we have to overcome. Thank you.
Thank you. Hello, first of all. Welcome all. I believe some of you have this question in your minds, and I believe some of you are looking for an answer from some of our mouths to this. What will the soldiers do? Are they going to watch, or are they going to do something? Something meaning an intervention to democracy. Remember in 2002 there was such a word around that even if AK Party won the election, they will never let them to take power. AK Party won the election and has been ruling the country since then. They became uneasy, but that's okay. Now, this time, the word was around saying that they would never let a leading AK Party figure to get elected as president. And if so, he will never be the host of Çankaya, the presidential palace. Now, Gül is elected, and he's sitting there. And as we speak right now, he's in Cyprus on his first official trip abroad, and for the first time with his wife Hayrunisa. Gül himself described the situation in his thank you speech to the parliament as Turkish democracy's maturity. Turkish democracy is getting matured. The same expression is later used in a few days' time, by first British Foreign Secretary David Miliband, and then a few days ago, Nicholas Burns used the same expression. Yes, the democratic rules worked. Democracy, as it is written in the book, is applied. Yes, there were some tension. There were a lot of tension at some point, but now things started to settle down. Is Turkish democracy mature enough? Not quite. So it's not a garden of roses yet. Yalçın Doğan listed some of the problems and worries, but let me give you the political side of it, the political problems that we are facing now and we may face in near future. First of all, we celebrated Gül congratulated him. But Gül, the way that Gül is get elected as president and the decision that Gül is a candidate might bring some problems, has brought some problems and might bring some new problems. I believe Gül won the presidency despite Erdogan's will. Fehmi Koru hinted some of it as by saying that now Erdogan has more hand, has more power in party politics. I agree with him. And I believe that in the last stage, if Gül didn't press enough, Erdogan would show somebody else, say defense minister or some other minister as candidate, not Abdullah Gül. But Abdullah Gül saw that that was the moment of opportunity and it was now or never. He pressed hard and he won. That's good. So Gül got Çankaya and Erdogan consolidated his power within party and government. From where we can conclude this? We can conclude this, for example, from the composition of his new cabinet, the 60th cabinet of Turkish Republic. Not so liberal as some of journalists had predicted or mispredicted before. Not so new names, number of new names are not much enough, many enough. So not so independent of the core of AK Party. Let me give you a few names which exemplifies that Erdogan consolidated his power in the party. For example, the whole infrastructural program of the new cabinet will be now carried out by his people from the municipality times. We had Energy Minister Hilmi Güler already. We had Transportation and Communications Minister Binali Yıldırım already. And now we are having Veysel Eroğlu as the head of a brand new ministry post as Environment, Urbanization and Water Resources, thanks to the global warming effect. All these three names were head of departments during his Istanbul municipality time. As deputy prime minister, replacing Abdullah Gül, for example, Cemil Çiçek, the former justice minister, is now in power as deputy prime minister number one, we can say. And two new names from the party ranks assumed the deputy prime ministerial positions, Nazım Ekren and Hayati Yazıcı. Nazım Ekren is a good economist. He used to be the deputy chairman of the party in charge of economic affairs. I believe he's going to accompany him in his trip to New York in a few days' time. Hayati Yazıcı is his personal lawyer for very long years, a very tight-lipped person as character, and he's now going to be one of other deputy prime ministers. Yes, there are new names, but they're not in very effective positions, except Mehmet Şimşek, who replaced Ali Babacan, our new foreign minister, as the treasury minister. He's a known international economist, he's a good economist, and he's now going to run the treasury. A second potential problem, shows itself as in this constitutional change debate. There's a very lively debate nowadays in Turkey, despite the understanding I started to feel here, though it's only new that I'm here this time, that, okay, elections are done and it's over and very good, mature democracy, garden of roses, which I claim it's not. The constitutional debate is very lively. First of all, the methodology is very debatable. Lack of transparency is a matter of criticism. I'll give you one example. despite heavy criticism, not only from opposition parties, but from many layers of society, including Rifat Sajikoğlu, he's not here yet, but many civil society leaders, AK Party decided to discuss the matter with EU ambassadors in Ankara. They declared this during a lunch. And there were a lot of criticism saying that, all right, before the Turkish parliament, before Turkish people, EU ambassadors are going to learn it openly for the first time. Is it true? Is it correct? So they have to revise the program. Erdogan got angry, it seems. He had a meeting today with his party officials on this constitutional draft thing, and they postponed the lunch with EU ambassadors, or dinner. I'm not sure whether it's lunch or dinner. So it fits to the game plan of AK Party. Why the constitutional change is needed? I personally believe that we need a new constitution. That's something else. The current constitution was prepared by the military regime. I'm wrapping it up. The military regime in 82. A third of it was already amended. So we need a constitution, an updated constitution, a freedom-oriented, a market-oriented constitution. That's all right. But the understanding of the AK Party is that in order to carry out reforms without blocking of the constitutional court, they needed a new constitution. The debate within AK Party is locked up in the headscarf issue again. And I don't know where it will go. We're still watching. But I'm telling you all these in order to show that not everything goes perfectly. And we might see some new debates, some new problems in the near future ahead of us. Thank you.
Thank you.
We've got a few minutes for questions. Raise your hand if you want to ask a question, identify yourself, and please make the question short. And we'll pass the question to each of the three panelists. Yes, back there. You, Mr. Ambassador, how are you?
To anybody who cares to answer, who will be running Turkish foreign policy in the period ahead? We've got at least, by my count, three contenders. How will that shake down?
Can I answer?
Sure.
It will be Erdogan. It will be Erdogan. Gül is coming. Gül has been a strong foreign minister. But again, all big decisions were made by Erdogan. Will Ali Babacan be overshadowed? That's a big question. Demirel will be under the shadow of Abdullah Gül and Erdogan. That's a question. That's a legitimate question. Demirel used to be a very strong president in foreign policy. Ecevit used to be a very strong prime minister in foreign policy, but late İsmail Cem managed to put his stamp on foreign policy issues with his knowledge and depth and character, etc. We are not sure, I'm not sure how this distribution of work will be done between three of them, but I believe the real boss of foreign policy will be Erdogan.
I don't share that opinion. because, well, I know that the foreign policy will be not run by Ali Babacan. That's the fact. But the answer to your question is also a question of all us, because there will be a competition, I believe, between Gül and Erdogan, who will be running the foreign policy, because both of them are very eager on the foreign policy. And I have been traveling with Erdogan throughout nearly all of the world, and I always remarked that he is very eager to solve any international problem by his own selves. For example, between Israel and Palestine, I was on that trip 2 years ago when he raised his hand to go between Palestine and Israel. But on the same day, there was two official announcements by both sides that they wouldn't need any country or any person by undergoing by to go between. So, and Gül is also eager on that, for running the foreign policy. So the answer to your question is still open.
I think Mr. Ambassador would expect my answer to this question, because I know why he raised this problem. President Gül was, of course, a foreign minister for many years in Turkey, so with his present position in the Çankaya Palace, many expects that he would intervene in day-to-day business of foreign affairs. But I don't believe this would be the case. He will stay behind the scene, and if there will be no radical developments which would concern his own intervention, he would never raise his voice in any of the foreign policy matters. This is my contention. Thank you.
Thank you.
No, the military did not say anything on the constitutional debate yet. Actually, we have, as journalists, we have some infiltrated news items, but we don't know the result of the debate yet. We have a leaked draft. That's all we have. So nobody actually knows, other than AK Party people, what is there.
Okay, one more answer.
Okay. Go ahead. It is a legitimate question, of course, but I think some people exaggerate what is happening right now in Turkey. I accept there is a test case right now we are experiencing, because in no time in our history, three most important civil positions have been occupied by the same kind of people. The president is from AK Party. The speaker of the parliament is also from the same party. And, the prime minister is from AK Party. With these three positions held by the same type of people, we may expect some kind of radical developments to take place. But I don't think this would be the case. I think they will behave within the constitutional rules, and there will be no threat coming from the political fields. As to the problem which would come from the public itself, religious-minded people, I don't think they would also do anything which would be harmful to the present setup of the country. But of course, they may have some problems, local problems, minor problems. But what is happening right now? Some people who feel that they have been neglected or left behind with the electorate, try to do a kind of a comeback by using that kind of small and minor and local things to their own benefit. And they exaggerate these kind of things. This is my view.
concentrate.
I understand your concern as a Muslim from Egypt, and I believe many in the Muslim world also try to take some lessons from what is happening in Turkey. Turkish case is a little bit different from the rest of the Islamic world. We have been living under a secular state for so many years, and the religiosity is very common in Turkey. So the people are Muslim, but the state is secular, which is a completely different type of system in the Islamic world. Well, democracy is the major thing that we can share with the rest of the Islamic world. And if the parties exercising their democratic rights in different Islamic countries also try to understand the basic elements of the AK party setup, they can also use that kind of understanding of the system, democracy and secularism and Islam, if they can get together, if they can put into practice together, also they can introduce this kind of understanding to their own societies. But it is not that easy, actually.
Can I? I believe democracy cannot work without secularism, especially in a Muslim society. That is the summary of it.
I would like also to add, and again, I don't share the view of Fehmi Koro, that there is an exaggeration. There is no exaggeration. The time in which we are living now is Ramadan in the whole Muslim world, including Turkey. Ramadan, so you fasten from the morning at 5 or 6 o'clock till in the late afternoon 6 or 7 o'clock. So during that daytime, it is nearly impossible to find any open restaurant in Anatolia. So if you don't, you don't fasten, but you don't find a place, to an open restaurant to eat something. So is that an exaggeration? I don't know.
Well, let me add one thing, actually. This is a very important topic, and incidentally, I read today's papers through the internet, and one of the major papers in Turkey has conducted a survey on this matter, sending their own people to look if the restaurants in the heart of Anatolia are open or not. And they published their findings today, saying that many of the cities, excepting one or two, have restaurants open to the public during the day. And maybe some restaurants with serving alcohol are not open during the day, but they are open after the break of the fasting. And I think it's business as usual.
We have a saying in Turkish, as Turkish friends here know, and those who know Turkey know. The coming of Thursday is obvious from Wednesday. So that is the answer for Iran. That's the answer for Iran. So we can see that if Iraq adventure is successful, yes, go ahead with Iran. On Nicholas Burns' comments, what is the initiative for Turkey? Is there an initiative for Turkey? What is the incentive for Turkey? Is there any? Why should Turkey cooperate more? If you have an answer, please tell me.
The most curious thing about this government, actually, which is the government cannot really present itself as what it is in terms of U.S.-Turkish relations. To many, this government is the most American, pro-American government. And some people regard this government as the most anti-American government. Well, I know some people, of course, from the government circles and many in the parliament. And I believe they regard the U.S. very highly. And they would like to put their priority of foreign policy just to praise and please the United States, but up to a point, of course. We know that we had some problems during the time of Iraqi war, and I believe if the time comes to decide if Turkey would support the Americans if they decide to open a war against Iran. I think not because of the government's position towards the United States, but especially because the people's position towards any kind of war in the region, any government, not only this one, can decide to support the American war against Iran 100%. So there will be some problems if the U.S. decides to wage a war against Iran. This is my...
On October 21st, we are amending the current constitution, but only for powers of the president. I believe those are going to be kept in the new constitution, well, the intention, at least, as such. Yes, the government says that they're going, once the draft is ready, they're going to open it to public debate. But it's a very interesting way of debating it. They're saying that we are going to put this on the internet site, so anyone who wants to contribute, please join. So that's the main methodology. If you think that this is a healthy way of debating a parliament, yes, it's going to be open to public debate. Differences, as far as we can judge from a very immature draft that is leaked to us, yes, there are some basic differences. First of all, it looks like that it will be more freedom and market-oriented constitution. there will be less control on every details of the social life or economic life, especially on economic life. But the debate is very immature. It will not be correct to judge from now. But as I told you, as far as we know, as far as we hear, the whole issue is again locked up in the headscarf issue, whether to free headscarf in university for university students. So we'll see. There's still room to watch. There's still time.
Unfortunately, our judicial power is not so powerful by making laws, by writing laws. On the referendum on the 21st of October, there is a sentence which you may know. The 11th president will be elected by the people. We have already elected the 11th president by the parliament. So there is a discussion now whether Gül is the, yes, he is the 11th president, but whether he will be re-elected or will be another election. So it has been discussing now. Nobody knows yet, but probably Gül will remain as the 11th president, but there should be found a judicial solution for that sentence, which will be coming on the 21st of October to the referendum. And what is the difference between the last constitution, which has been making now? I think it is, of course, not so easy to minimize a constitution to a one point. But if we try to minimize our constitution, 82, to a one point, is the idea of that constitution is to forbid the right of organization in the whole. With that constitution, it is nearly impossible in the way of democratic life to organize yourself. So the biggest difference will be the freedom of organization for the whole community in the Turkish society. It will bring, we hope, a strong parliamentarian system where the president would have no such rights like now. The parliamentarian system, the government will be more strong, the parliamentarian system, the parliament itself will be more strong, which is democratic. We don't know yet the main factors which are the any kind of freedom in the constitution. We don't know yet. And how to discuss it, to back to your first question, I think we shall have enough time. I mean, the press, the universities, political parties, any societies in the civil societies. So there will be a great discussion, and I hope out of that discussion we shall get a reasonable constitution, I think.
I think what we are witnessing right now in terms of new constitution is a first phase of a debate which will go for some time to come. So there will be too much to discuss about the new constitution. I would like to share my disappointment with the preparation of the new constitution, because I was expecting that the new constitution, as the name implies, would be a brand new constitution, which would cover all the necessary aspects of a democratic state, encompassing all the rights and the rights of the individual, especially, and nothing taken into account, nothing outside of the rights and freedoms taken into account. What we have right now, going through the press coverages, what I see is a new constitution by name only. It is the it is exactly the same kind of constitution we have, with some superfluous changes. I believe there will be we will have a new constitution, a brand new constitution, rather than a patch up kind of a text that we will call it as a constitution. This is my contention.
We have time for one more question. You get it.
Thanks. My name is Gucci Sus. I have a question for all three of you. And the question is, do you think that any kind of political Islam is compatible with Turkish secularism? And if so, how does it differ institutionally and in character from what AKP has been exhibiting?
Comparable, because actually the Turkish Republic is a secular state for the 85 years. So and there was some quarrels during the 80 years. There were three main streams: anti-republican, communism, anti-secularism, and Kurdish. Ethnicity. The communism felt itself down, so we don't have any problem anymore with that communism. With the other two main streams against Republic, we have still problems, which we were not able until now to overcome them. Nevertheless, the AKP government has a great tendency to its Islamic roots, but by ruling the country, as I said before, of course their attitude is within the constitution and within the laws, but the practice of it is different than the others. And actually, we have to confess and to underline that there is a great, incomparable difference from the other Islamic countries, because they are not secular, but Turkey is secular. And what is secularism? If we want to know that. The question, the answer to that question, is the way of life. In the Islamic countries, especially in the Arabic countries, the way of life is Islamic. Well, you think Islamic, you treat Islamic, yourself and the other one. And it is not the case in Turkey. So we are now discussing not to go through that way.
I don't think AK Party is an Islamic party or an Islamist party, whatever you call it. But I believe the AK Party leaders are Democrats with religious inclinations. So you cannot really compare them as Islamic or Islamically oriented parties of the Islamic world. They have been in power for 5 years now, and they haven't done anything to jeopardize the secular setup of the country or do anything against the basic principles of the secular state. Thank you.
I believe any kind of religious rule will not be compatible with democracy. I believe democracy without secularism cannot be a democracy. But I don't also know what is moderate Islam. If anyone will bring a definition for that hypothetical expression, I'm ready to debate.
Ulan, have we run out of time? Okay. Thank you very much, all of our panelists. I think they deserve a big round of applause. Ulan, I think we've answered all three questions. Major questions. You won't need a third seminar.
So we're going to cancel the next one. Thanks, Nelson. Okay. Take a couple of minutes while some people leave, but the next panel is going to be on the economy. So those of you with an interest in the economic situation, we got one which is going to be somewhat abbreviated to about half hour.
Surya at the end. Thank you.
Thank you,
Bill. That was really wonderful. I was wondering who it was.
That was great.
Between the state and their backers, almost inevitable. Cousin Navek. Çok şükür. Şikayetim yok. Okay. Şimdi Türk işi ha. Herkes herkesle konuşuyor. Elçilikte yemekteyiz.
Ha, elçilikte.
Tamam. Harika kardeşim. Turkish all that. I'll plug it, that horse. You got a Leningrad. You're a Turk, so everyone's going to say goodbye to everybody else, and then we'll drive back. I'll give a En azından oturursanız yavaş yavaş başlayalım. Allah'ım
Güven Bey, Güven Bey. Buyursanız yavaş yavaş. Excuse me. Can those of you staying behind grab your chairs, please? Okay, can you grab your chair so we can start, please? We've got about half hour. Okay, thank you. We've got about barely half hour before the president and his delegation are going to go and see President Zelik at the World Bank. Now, needless to say, TOB is Turkey's most powerful business grouping, and the president in his presentation talked about the economic transformation, the changes since the crisis of 2001. Turkey is now the 17th largest economy, and what he said, which I found very striking, was that it was now that the elections are out of the way, it was back to business, and five more years of economic performance is what he wanted. Now, we have two speakers here, neither of whom we need any kind of introduction, but they're both attached very quickly, as you saw from the little note we put at the bottom. They're both attached to TEPAV. We have Güven Sak, who's the executive director of TEPAV, which was established with the support of TOB, who is also the director of Economic Policy Research Institute there. And next to him, Süreyya Serdengeçti, who's also at TEPAV. He's the director of the Economic Stability Institute. We literally have about half hour, and those of you who stayed on, I think, are in for a very enjoyable and informative session where we're going to talk about the Turkish economic recovery, the prospects for its continuation, and without further ado, Süreyya Serdengeçti will kick us off. Haley, could you possibly shut the door? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ali Rıza. I understand that politics somewhat attracted more kind of attention compared with the economy, so some of the audience has already left, and I also understand that we don't have much time. So I'll be as brief as possible so that you can also benefit from the views of Güven Sak, who will have to be also brief, just like me. But anyway, we'll try to be helpful. I still think after 26 years of service at the central bank, which is now being followed by my service at the TOB, I still believe the economy comes first. What happened in the last 6 years, in fact, sheds a lot of light, if I can say like that, a lot of light on what is happening on the political scene anyway. So we have to remember that again so that we can see where we are now exactly as far as the Turkish economy is concerned and what is or what should be on the agenda again as far as the economy is concerned. The last time I talked to an audience here, I remember having told you about what happened in the last 6 years. You are all familiar with that. Disinflation, the progress that we made with the public debt, the increasing demand for the local currency, which came after three decades. And all these developments obviously had one aim, all these positive developments. Anybody with the slightest familiarity with the macroeconomic stabilization will know it. The aim was to ensure higher growth rates in Turkey. After all, we know that up to 2002, the average annual growth rate in the country has been a mere 3.9%, whereas since 2002, the average is 7.4%. Clearly, stabilization made a difference. It's not only the high growth rates, of course, it's also the structural change that we have seen in the growth pattern in the country. For instance, just a few points on that. The growth this time, since 2002, is rather coming from the private sector, whereas in the past it has always come from the public sector and could not be sustained. We have seen a huge surge in productivity, and we have also seen during this period, quite interesting, the Turkish economy integrating more and more with the global economy. Why did I start my words by saying, where do we stand exactly now? It is very much related to the growth story that I just told you. Because where we stand now, we also see that though we have enjoyed all these high growth rates, they have also brought problems. One problem is in the area of the external balances, namely the current account deficit. In Turkey, there's always a debate going on about the current account deficit because it has not yet stabilized, and whether it is related to the exchange rate, it is related to the energy prices or growth. At the central bank, during all this period, my mind was rather clear on that. Of course, it has a relationship to the exchange rate appreciation, but it was quite normal that the exchange rate has appreciated after three decades as the stabilization program has been successful. We know that, at TEPAV at least, but also at the central bank and the treasury, they also know it. We know that it is also very much related to the worldwide energy prices that we have seen since 2002. Many studies tell us that if energy prices stood where they were back in 2002, the Turkish current account would stabilize somewhere around 4 or 5%. Anyway, the energy prices didn't stay there, so we had a deteriorating current account. And then the third point is very important. Again, I'm coming back to the growth issue. The Turkish current account deterioration has been very much related to the higher than estimated growth rates that we have enjoyed. One important point again. Still, there are many people in Turkey who think the government or the economy at large has a growth target, which is not the case. It's not a common economy. Not all the aggregates in an economy can become targets. We have even seen ministers who think like that, but this is not the case. We had growth estimates throughout that period. And the growth estimate that has been put under the stabilization program has been 5% only annually. And the average, as I mentioned, was 7.4%. That explains why we have a larger than anticipated current account deficit. We know that in any economy where total investments exceed total savings, there will be a current account deficit. And the excessive surge that we have seen in investments is related, obviously, to growth. We also know, it's just a simple study that we have done at the Stability Institute, that whenever domestic demand shows some slowing down, not much, it didn't happen in the last 6 years anyway, the current account deficit also shows some signs of stabilization. But it doesn't last because domestic demand picks up again, and then we have the same story, and we continue like that. Now, what should we do? Last year or so, there have been some discussion in the press about the necessity of curbing down growth. Since the current account situation was not sustainable, all Turkey had to do, some people said, we have to curb down growth. And at the top, we have always resisted that idea for a number of reasons. First of all, we believe that Turkey needs a high level of sustainable growth. What do we mean by a high level? Well, it's difficult to give you an exact figure on that. There have been many studies, but I will be very simple, as I've always been in that. A high level of growth that we need it for two reasons mainly. One, unemployment is still high, and we have to get it down. That is very clear, and the politicians understand it very clearly anyway. The other issue is that the Turkish economy has to catch up with the European Union. When you look at the income per capita in Turkey compared with income per capita in Europe, we see that Turkey, in fact, was not able to close the gap in the last three decades or so because of sluggish growth rates. But in fact, it has to do so. And in order to be able to do so, it has to grow quite fast. There are still some preliminary studies about what should be that growth rate, which would, on the one hand, provide employment, and on the other hand, would help us to close the gap with the European Union. There have been some studies done at the State Planning Agency, at the Central Bank too, and I understand at TEPAV too, there have been some preliminary studies on that. No study points to a growth rate lower than 7% anyway. If, to put it in other words, if Turkey grows lower than 7% on an annual basis, Turkey goes nowhere. So, what to do then? Because I don't think again, we always have that debate in Turkey. I don't think the exchange rate is any remedy. Many people call for the depreciation of the lira, not only because of the current account, but because of many reasons. No, it's not the answer. Many people call for lower interest rates in the economy. There's always a pressure on the central bank. I know I've lived through it. I think it continues. There's always talk about the very high levels of real interest rates, and we have to get them down, but I don't think the answer lies there. The answer is not easy. The answer lies in the area of structural reforms, no question about it. And that is the difficult thing. First of all, in order to be able to continue with higher growth rates, we have to, of course, ensure capital account stability, which has been coming since 2003. Though there is still a lot of talk about the importance of hot money in the Turkish economy, we know for sure that the amount of hot money, percentage-wise, in the financing of the current account deficit is getting down since 2003. And again, the percentage-wise, the amount of long-term investment or FDI is increasing all the time. But that is something quite welcome, of course. But it's not enough. At the top again, we always talk about the necessity of the government dealing with an industrial policy, a sound industrial policy. This idea has been championed by TOB all the time, but the government has to make its mind about what sectors to be supported in Turkey, think about the value added and the global prospects and all that. The government also has to concentrate in the area of microeconomic reforms. Just to give you a few examples, they have to concentrate on entry and exit costs, for instance, and also on the problems of scale. There are a long list of things to do in that area. Well, I can only mention the commercial code, for instance, or the work to be done in the area of property rights, and also the judicial reform, of course. Another area is about access to finance. Though we have seen a huge increase in the credit volume of the banking system in the last few years again, thanks to the stabilization of the economy, we still know that the balance sheet of the banking system in Turkey is very largely dominated by the public sector. This is still the case. And this has to change. Of course, there are many problems. One is related to the size of our banking system, which could never develop quite satisfactorily because of the unstable environment of the past. And that also the banks simply borrowing from abroad and lending credit to the government resulted in the firms trying to use their own resources instead of bank credits for their development. But, of course, that wasn't very much helpful. And there are many problems to be solved in that area again, such as the costs of intermediation, which are quite high. We have to think about the reforming the regulatory framework for the credit mechanisms. We have to do more work on mortgages and the mortgage systems. We have to prepare our country for Basel II. And finally, we have to develop capital markets to ensure more access to finance for the real sector. We have to develop capital markets and instruments, especially corporate bonds and pension issues are very much related to that. Of course, we have to fight a large unregistered economy in the Turkish economy, which is coupled with our efforts in the area of tax reform and also the budget reform. There have been a lot of delays in these areas, but we have to do all that. One other area is obviously related to the unemployment issue, which I deemed as very important a few minutes ago. The labor market reform is pending, and it is becoming now one of the most important reforms. There are a lot of rigidities on employment in Turkey. There is a huge tax burden, again, on employment. And more, we believe we have to think about the education or training issues related to employment. Anyway, I won't keep citing you all the reforms that we need. Just we can be sure about it. If we want to continue with high growth rates and at the same time we want our current account to stabilize, the only area we have to concentrate is the structural reform areas. And there, a few final words on it. I keep saying publicly all the time that the first 100 days after any election is very important for any government to do the structural reforms. Because the structural reforms are quite bitter for the public at the first phase, and the best period to go ahead with them is the first 100 days after the elections. This idea is already in the economic literature based on the experience of Chilean governments in the past, who have been quite successful, by the way, and we keep urging the government about it, and we will see what they do. The other issue, when we are talking about structures, of course, I already gave you a long list, which can be even longer, but the other issue is about the priorities. which structural reform will be on the agenda first, and which others will follow after that. This is a very, very delicate issue, and it has to be thought about very carefully. The priorities issue is also related to the fact that, and this is also my personal experience, any stabilization program, if it is successful, let alone being unsuccessful, if it is successful, it also produces a lot of opposition to it, because there are a lot of segments of society who, instead of benefiting from the fruits of this stabilization program, in fact, suffer from it. And politicians have to know how to handle these segments of society. So the priorities issues is also related to how the government will handle the resistance to further stabilization of the economy. The final words are about two important points. One, the institutional setup. In Turkey, we've been quite late in learning the importance of institutional economics. We are still learning it. But I had the privilege of having a first-hand experience as the central bank got independent when I became the governor. That was 6 years ago. I believe that was a very important reform, and it should not necessarily end up with the central bank. It should continue in other areas of the institutional setup in Turkey. Economic coordination is an issue. Central bank independence, we have to continue to defend it. And finally, the communications policy. Again, my experience tells me that the communications policy, if it is sound and effective, it will help you with your stabilization efforts. Otherwise, all these efforts may end nowhere. It will continue to become important in the future. I think I should stop here. I've been quite quick, I know, but we had such a little time. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Now, Güven Sak.
Let me be very brief. So 5 minutes. You tell me after 5 minutes. Süreyya Bey has already laid out all the things regarding Turkey. I'm just going to underline a few issues that's important from now on. What has happened in Turkey with the elections, with these twin elections that we had, an episode has been closed, and a new episode is about to start. And this is about, I'm an economist, this is about the economic transformation of Turkey. And I kind of like these political Islam arguments, you know, the compatibility of Islam with democracy, etc. The best test for me regarding this, when I look at the situation, we haven't seen anybody putting a AKP flag upon the parliament after the elections. You know, that happened in Palestine, after the Palestinian elections, for example. So Turkey is a country where there are some traditions and where there is some institutional development, and this is a long period of capitalist transformation in Turkey, and we are at a certain stage of that transformation. An era has been closed. The era is an era of 30 to 35 years, an era about where the binding constraint for the Turkish economy, where the binding constraint for the Turkish economic transformation was macroeconomic instability in the country. We have achieved this, as Süreyya Bey has mentioned. We have solved that constraint in the Turkish economy. Rapid trade integration process has started, a rapid trade and financial integration process has started in the Turkish economy. Now what we have got to do, we have to complete the second process to integrate the Turkish economy, to make Turkish economy a part of the global economy. That's now the major issue that we have got to solve. So the challenge now and the question that we have got to ask now is, can AKP achieve this second transformation wave, which is much more important, much more deeper than the earlier one? That's the question that we have got to focus on, because there are differences from the case in 2002. After 2002 elections, you know, we already had an economic program. We already, all the actors, including the IMF, had a role in that program. Everything was set. So when the AKP came to power, they just have got to implement the program that was already there. Now, there is the need to define a new program for this deeper integration of the Turkish economy to the global process. And we all know, I know, that AKP is not, you know, best known because of its ability to design new programs, to design reform programs. So they need help. When I look at it, they need help in doing that. And the second issue is the nature of coordination. Coordination of economic policies is totally different from the one in 2001. In 2001, the system of coordination is binary. Spend or do not spend. It's easier. That kind of coordination is much easier. What the basic message that you are sending to the line agencies, etc., is do not spend, do not do anything, do not undertake your role in the economy. But now, in the deeper transformation of Turkey now, in the deeper integration of the Turkey into the global economy, now every ministry has got to perform, has got to do what that ministry was established for. They have got to do their job now. And now that requires a broader economic coordination framework, and now it is the real thing. The real process is now about to start, and as far as we know up until now, there is no such coordination mechanism, and there is the need to establish a coordination mechanism. Thirdly, this is the time now, you know, like during war times, it's easier to take decisions. But during peace times, it's harder to take decisions. And now, at this stage, it's harder, and there is the need to make choices, and now it's harder to make those choices. And the choices that we have got to make for this deeper integration process is in the education, in the field of education, in the field of health, in the field of judiciary reform. All these areas are very much important, and in all those areas, and we haven't touched upon anything in those areas in the last, let's say, 80 to 50 years. We haven't done anything. So there is the need to design a program, and that program has got to contribute to the economic reform process, has got to contribute to the productivity in our corporate sector, etc. So there is the need to make choices. And fourthly, in order to make those choices rightly, there is the need for, as Reyabe has mentioned, a communication strategy now. And as we all know, when you look at, for example, the how the constitutional reform process is managed in Turkey, and AKP could not be, you know, praised because of its ability of having a strong communication policy and a communication strategy. So that's why at TEPA also we are trying to find ways to foster this process, because at top there is the intention of fostering this deeper integration into the global economy. Everybody in Turkey would like that to continue, but there is the need to define a communication strategy, to define a program framework, and there is the need to define a coordination mechanism in among the ministries. And this seems to be lacking at the moment. Let me stop here.
Okay, we got a few minutes, and let me ask a question which will actually relate what you said to what TOP is doing in and out of the country. The extent to which TOP represents the entire Turkish business community from one end of Turkey to the other is undeniable. It does so more than any other institution in Turkey. And you have an interaction, TOP has an interaction with the government. All those issues you talked about, and Zirayabe talked about, to what extent are you getting the government, it happens to be the AK government at the moment, but whatever government, to respond to those and to go through with the second transformation in a manner that pleases and encourages and supports the business industry? Are you happy with it? And are you? Do you have criticism of the way it's happening?
I cannot answer on behalf of TOP. TOP's chairman is there, so he can talk.
But you're talking about TOP.
I can tell you my personal view regarding the issue. It has been now, how long? 2 months. And we still haven't started, talking about actual programs, but we haven't even started talking about what we are going to do from now on the economy front, because this political discussion process has not ended yet.
So 60 days of the
100
days
hasn't started.
So 60 days of the 100 days is gone. Okay,
that's how I see it personally.
That's unfortunate to hear. Sir Abby?
Yeah, I mean, I have nothing to add. That was exactly what I thought.
Okay, we could take a couple of questions and then we go. Go ahead, sir.
Regarding the education reform, for example, yes, we have now finished a study at DEPA on the priorities of the second generation reform process that the Turkey has got to embark upon from now on. And on education, for example, about a year and a half ago, together with the World Bank, we have finished a study, and we had a survey with all the top members regarding their requirements for productivity increases. And that input was already placed in the World Bank documents. But even that report wasn't yet, you know, launched in Turkey. We have finished an investment climate assessment study, again, with the World Bank. Hopefully in a month or so we'll launch the study now. But we have finished it about a year ago. You know, in the last year or a year and a half, the government did not have the time to focus on these economic reform issues yet. So I hope that it's going to start from now on. But the table is not empty. There are already so many studies. And that means, if there are studies, that means that there are some group of experts that are ready to contribute to the discussion process. But the issue is to have the coordination mechanism in place at the moment.
You have the final question of the... I'll see you quick.
Good question, really. First of all, as far as the central bank independence is concerned, my six-year experience can be summarized in a few sentences. One, especially after leaving the central bank, after I started to work with TOP, and therefore I've been touring the country, visiting all the chambers and all that, and talking to audiences all the time, I realized once again that the society in Turkey has come to understand that the central bank independence is a good thing. This is the first point. The second point, my experience again shows me, and it's not unique for Turkey, I have to tell you, the politicians will never, never, never come to terms with the central bank independence. No, I'm very open on that. It's not only the AKP government. I know what happened before. I know how we got our independence back in 2001. We owe it to a crisis, I have to tell you. We had inflation for three decades at the time, and the parliament had always hesitated to grant independence to the central bank. But the crisis, and right after the crisis, we have found our kind of golden moment. As the Chinese say, crisis in Chinese, I understand, also means opportunity. And that really fits the Chinese understanding of the world crisis. So the problem still continues. I mean, I'm not necessarily talking about what happened last week. Of course, I'm not in a position to know. We have to wait, by the way, for the central bank's monthly report, which has not yet come out. So just the two paragraphs come out after every decision, but it's not enough to explain the rationale behind the decision. We have to wait for the long report, and maybe we are criticizing now the central bank a bit unfairly. We will know about it anyway. These are my points. About the Constitution, that's a very good question, and that makes me tell you about a kind of anecdote that goes back several years. I had become a very newly vice governor, and I was delivering a speech somewhere in the United States. At that time, the central bank was not independent, and Turkey has been living in an inflation environment for so many decades, and I just explained the Turkish economy, but not much promising anyway. Somebody in the audience, just like yourself, has asked me a question. Is there any constitutional kind of difficulty for the central bank independence in Turkey? Whoever asked the question was quite kind of gentle, you see. The question, in another blunt fashion, could be read as this. Why doesn't the Turkish government grant independence to the central bank after so many years of inflation? At that time, I thought there was no, of course, constitutional anyway difficulties in granting central bank independence. But of course, it would be better if it was more protected by the constitution. If it was made a fundamental law, as we call it in Turkey, you see, for instance, if it has given such a role so that other laws will not interfere with it. That always happens in Turkey, by the way. I think it would be better. Miss anything? Okay.
Sorry, guy. I thought the question from my friend from the Treasury was going to be the last, but I think we may just take one from the Turkish media. But can you keep it very brief, and then we're going to wind it up? Because Mr. Zolik, although he was a former president of CSIS, will not take kindly to the idea of Mr. Hasegic Dolar keeping him waiting. Please go ahead.
What did the Fed do with interest rates today?
Half a point.
Okay. But still, Treasury Secretary Paulson wants that the subprime mortgage crisis will continue to take more toll and it will take more time to overcome this crisis anyway. Do you think this will be over for Turkey, and given the current account situation, will Turkey be continue to be affected really badly, severely?
By the subprime mortgage crisis? Sorry. I don't have any idea about what kind of a report came out of the Fed Reserve, and I don't think it's coming out today anyway. Just like in Turkey, they need a few days before they publish what they think and why they did that rate cut, right? Okay. So we have to see that report before I can give you a satisfactory answer. But unfortunately, by that time, I won't be in the United States, but back in Turkey now.